Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 444. This is an interview with author Peter Vogel on his research on Port Chicago. This is being recorded on February 1st of 2004. And for newer listeners who are not familiar with the research that's been done by our guest is Peter Vogel, the author of the online book, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, and a diligent researcher who has uncovered a fascinating and very important piece of history, not only in the development of nuclear weapons, in particular the World War II development of atomic weapons, but also a very important piece of history of the African-American community, and February is Black History Month. It is my pleasure to present Peter Vogel. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thanks very much, Dave. It's good to be back For the Record and be back with you.
Well, since you last visited with us a few years ago, you have condensed your research into an online book called The Last Wave from Port Chicago. Give us the web address, if you would, for your online book.
It is at www.portchicago.com. .org. Port Chicago is one word, so it's www.portchicago.org.
So through the magic of the internet, something that has come into its own, it really has emerged since we last visited, people can now read at length and in detail about your research. Peter, let's get right into the subject of Port Chicago, and your odyssey in researching this historical event began with your discovery of a document entitled History of the 10,000-Ton Gadget at a Rummage Sale. Tell us about that, if you would.
That's correct. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I was living in 1980, was interested in photography at that time, still am, and I went to a rummage sale at the Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church there, and in the bottom of a box that included photographic materials, I found an envelope, a letter-sized envelope that had this piece of paper folded up in it, which I unfolded and looked at, and recognized that it was a document that described an atomic bomb detonation, and I figured immediately that it had probably been taken from Los Alamos, which is 30 miles northeast of Santa Fe. And I bought the document from the rummage sale for 25 cents and took it home and started looking at it and realized that I had a very significant document in my hands. And was particularly attracted to what the bottom line says, which is ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. I pretty much right away figured out that this document had been composed prior to the 1945 Trinity site test of an atomic bomb in New Mexico, because if a description of an atomic a fireball was to be made there after the Trinity site explosion, it would certainly have said ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Trinity site fashion. It said Port Chicago, which I really didn't know anything about at that time and had forgotten what I knew about it earlier, and began some research into the subject of the State Library and found no reference whatsoever to Port Chicago. And then was working at that time with a number of physicists and other scientists who had been at Los Alamos during World War II. And I showed this document around to them, and I said, what does the bottom line here mean, ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion? And they all said that they had never heard of Port Chicago, didn't have any idea what it meant, but they all agreed that Edward Teller, the supposed father of the H-bomb, would know what Port Chicago was. So I had studied physics with Dr. Teller at Berkeley in the mid-60s and had known him pretty well in the context of our studies. So I set up an appointment in August of 1980 to meet with him in his office at Los Alamos. And there, when we did meet, I pulled this thing out and put it into his hands, this document, and asked him to look at it while I took some pictures of him. He started reading the document, and I took some very interesting pictures of him reading this historical document, one of which is posted on the website with the book. And then I said, what's the bottom line mean, Ed, where it says ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion? And he just kind of went a little bit ballistic at that point and immediately said that he would deny he had ever seen this document and would deny that he had ever spoken with me about Port Chicago. Then he said I probably had a classified document and I should take it immediately over to the classification office at the laboratory there where we were at Los Alamos.
So in other words, he mushroomed out in typical Port Chicago fashion.
And he, Edward Teller, just said, well, you know, he would never acknowledge having seen the document and would never acknowledge having discussed Port Chicago, but I had good photographs of him reading the document. So eventually, that is to say, a couple weeks later, the classification office at Los Alamos told me to look up Port Chicago under disasters in the Americana Encyclopedia, and I first learned there about the explosion of Port Chicago. Now, this document, which is reproduced in a couple places in the book on the web, is available for everyone to see. There, in the beginning, especially Dave, there were people who thought perhaps I had forged this document and that it was not authentic.
Can you tell us about the authorship of the document as you've been able to determine it?
Well, yes. When I published my first article on Port Chicago in 1982, I attributed authorship to Joseph O. Hirschfelder, the mathematician, and with the assistance of William George Penny, a British physicist who was at Los Alamos at that time. And I really didn't have any way to prove it, but it sure looked like it. Finally, the Department of Energy publication, a book published in 1991, Critical Assembly, authenticated the fact that Hirschfelder and Penny had written this document. So that established the authorship. Hirschfelder, who died in 1991, was a mathematician and a chemist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And George Penny was a British physicist who's actually known as the Oppenheimer of Britain and was responsible for developing and testing the first British atomic bomb. But there were still people who doubted the authenticity of the document, and I'm happy to say now that 9 months ago, two things happened, which are not up on the web yet, but I'd like you to be the first to know about.
Okay.
9 months ago, an individual at the Department of Energy, who prefers to remain anonymous, sent me a copy of the cover letter that accompanied distribution of the document, History of 10,000-Ton Gadget, accompanied distribution of that document at Los Alamos in 1945. That document is also signed by Joseph Hirschfelder, which again authenticates that he wrote the document. Now, DOE sent me that document after I had posted the chapter on the web gives a critical explanation and analysis of that document in Chapter 6. And I had quite a bit of difficulty with that over the years because there's a lot of scientific notation in there that was difficult for me to understand. And I finally got it figured out, and I posted all of that on the web and got it all right. And then DOE sent me this cover letter that explains all the scientific notation that occurs in the document and basically just shows that I finally got it all correctly. So then the other thing that happened 9 months ago, BBC Channel 5 was doing a film documentary on the work I'd done on Port Chicago, and then the commissioners at BBC in London decided not to do it because all I had was this copy of the document. And 2 months after that, the National Nuclear Security Administration in Albuquerque sent me a letter that acknowledged that indeed the document History of 10,000-Ton Gadget had been stolen from Los Alamos and that I indeed had recovered it at a rummage sale and that I had returned the document to the archives at Los Alamos and so on and so forth. So the document is finally completely authenticated by the National Nuclear Security Administration and the Department of Energy.
Well, good. That's something of a holy grail attained, I think, under the circumstances. And given the controversial nature of the research itself, Peter, you broached Dr. Donald M. Kerr, who was the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, about the paper. How did he react?
Well, he was, unnerved. I was preparing to begin a period of 3 years of work with him, a period that turned out to be 3 years. And before we began our work together, I met with him in his office at Los Alamos, and I put a copy of this document into his hands, and I said that I was reasonably confident. This was in autumn 1980, so I'd had the entire summer and autumn of the year 1980 to study this document. And I told Dr. Kerr at that time, I said, I'm reasonably confident that the cause of the Port Chicago explosion was an unannounced test of a low-yield experimental fission device that was conducted jointly by the Navy, United States Navy, in Los Alamos. And he first said that he would he reached for his telephone, and he said, I'll get Ed Teller on the phone, and he'll dispel that notion. And I said, well, don't bother, because I've already spoken with him and, of course, photographed him in August. So then he turned back to me and he said, you'll never be able to prove it. And I said, well, I'm certainly going to do the best that I can, and I intend to make it a public issue. And then, as I say, you know, we worked 3 years together and got along quite well all during that time. After our time together, Dr. Kerr stayed at Los Alamos, I think, for a year, perhaps two, and then he went into private industry. At the time, I was finishing up the book 2 years ago, and I knew that it was going to be completed, and I was confident that I had all the evidence that was necessary. I called him where he was working then, at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. He was then the assistant director of the FBI and director of the FBI laboratory division, which is the forensic laboratory of the FBI. I told Dr. Kerr at that time that the book was coming, and we then exchanged some written correspondence, postal correspondence, in which I briefly described the work, the Mark II, and the manifestation of the fireball. And said that I believed that the legal issues involved were two, that the Congressional Declaration of War against the Empire of Japan, the declaration of war that had put us into World War II, comprehended the legitimacy of a test at Port Chicago, and that probably the test at Port Chicago of the Mark II was legal. And the other thing I questioned was whether or not there had been a what I called a concerted effort by government officials to withhold information about the Port Chicago explosion from this investigator. Well, now, Dr. Kerr, since, and it's been about 2 years now, he's now the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, deputy director there at CIA for Science and Technology. And I haven't spoken to him in the last 2 years. But the indications I have are that that he's completely aware that the book has been published and has become familiar with the contents.
Peter, now, of course, one of the things, let's get into the subject of the actual physical characteristics of the explosion. Officially, this explosion took place on July 17th, 1944, and officially it was the explosion of hundreds of tons of TNT and Torpex that were being loaded onto an ammunition ship, the E.A. Bryan, which was anchored at the Port Chicago Munitions Depot in Suisun Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area. Hundreds of black sailors died. You know, what was the precise death total in the Port Chicago explosion?
320 men were killed in the explosion, of which 202, I believe, were African-American enlisted men of the United States Navy. The E.A. Bryan was a Liberty ship moored to the shiploading pier at Port Chicago, and had taken on a charge of 1,570 tons TNT and Torpex, which was contained in 5 million pounds of wartime munitions.
And now the explosion itself... was attributed to the detonation of these conventional munitions. In the course of your research, you have tackled the physical aspects of the actual explosion at Port Chicago, and there are a number of different aspects of the physical explosion that, according to research, preclude the possibility that it could have been the conventional explosion that it was. I wonder if you would detail those factors for us.
Sure. Be glad to, Dave. The first and most important artifact is the ball of fire. And we know from the document history of 10,000-ton gadget that Joseph Hirschfelder, a scientist at Los Alamos, characterized the Port Chicago fireball to have been typical of a nuclear fireball, a ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. So it was that statement first that got my attention. And so a great deal of my investigation of the manifestations of the explosion was concerned with the fireball, which, because of the extremely high temperature of a nuclear fission explosion, is quite different than the kind of amorphous mass of hot gases that is generated by a chemical explosion, for example, TNT or Torpex. So I started with that and then began to look at all the manifestations of the explosion. Now, this weapon, which was tested at Port Chicago on the 17th of July, 1944, was a very low-yield fission device. We'll talk about that in a while. For the moment, we'll refer to it as the Mark II, so Roman number 2. Now, basically what happened was the Mark II, a very low-yield fission weapon of about 200 to 300 tons TNT equivalent, was detonated first. And that precipitated the detonation of these 1,570 tons of TNT and Torpex in the munitions. And it was within the larger explosion that the fireball emerges, typically, from the Port Chicago explosion.
And that is characteristic of a nuclear explosion, but not a conventional explosion.
That's absolutely correct. And there are certain physical manifestations of the fireball that can be recognized. For example, because of the heat, the extreme heat, you know, million degrees Celsius, the rate of ascent, the whoosh, the way this fireball goes up, and the rate of ascent that it experiences as it begins and reaches the top of its rise is very, very much faster than anything that temperature of a chemical TNT explosion can produce. And it will also rise to a much greater height. And that's also true of the succeeding flame from this. All right, so we have the fireball, which Los Alamos has already described as being typical of a nuclear explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was the most definitive artifact of the Port Chicago explosion.
A couple of points that I'd like you to develop for us, too, briefly, because we have a lot of other information
sure.
to cover. But the eyewitnesses who described a brilliant white flash, which illuminated the area to the quality of noonday light, distinguish that from, or explain the white flash and what makes that distinctive. And also, a pilot noted what appeared to be a smoke ring around the explosion. I wonder if you tell us about what a Wilson condensation cloud is, and in combination with the white flash, the significance of those two pieces of physical evidence.
Sure. Now, a nuclear explosion is very, very hot, million degrees, and when you have a temperature that hot from an explosion in the atmosphere, it heats the atmosphere to a luminescence which is not achieved by any other source. And in that moment of luminance, when the atmosphere is just brilliantly hot, it generates what we perceive as a white flash of light. And that occurred at Port Chicago. And the white flash, the initial flash of light from the Port Chicago explosion illuminated the city of Napa, which is, I believe, 30 miles away, as if in noonday. An intensely white flash. Now, part of that, and I think it's interesting to note that Los Alamos, the way they planned this in the Navy, you know, is very carefully done. There was a considerable amount of Torpex on the pier, and Torpex munitions that were included in the load aboard the ship, the E.A. Bryan. Now, Torpex, when it explodes, because it has aluminum in it, will also create a white flash. And it was just one more way that Los Alamos and the Navy was able to conceal the artifact of this characteristic artifact of a nuclear explosion at Port Chicago. Now, the condensation cloud, when there is a large explosion, a pressure wave radiates from the center of the explosion, and it compresses the atmosphere. And when that happens and the pressure goes up, the water vapor that's in the atmosphere is condensed to water. So it becomes actually a visible water vapor, like a cloud, like a fog. And that was clearly observed by two airline pilots who were flying line of sight toward Port Chicago at the time of the explosion. They described this enormous smoke ring that was produced by the Port Chicago explosion.
And that is characteristic of the Wilson condensation cloud, is characteristic of nuclear explosions that occur on or over water.
That's true. There's some evidence, however, that a Wilson condensation cloud in the same circumstances can be produced by a very large TNT detonation. But the diameter of the Wilson condensation cloud that is produced by conventional explosions will be very, very much smaller than the diameter of Wilson condensation cloud in the same conditions that's produced by an atomic bomb because of the heat and pressure.
All right, Peter, we've got about 5 more minutes on this side of the interview. What are some of the other aspects of the physical evidence of the Port Chicago explosion that, in your opinion, refute the conventional explanation, namely that it was the detonation of standard munitions?
Well, actually, the only things that are really distinctive are the fireball, the rate of ascent of the fireball, the height which it achieved, and to a certain extent the Wilson condensation cloud. That's what made this thing so remarkable, so indistinguishable from the background of a chemical explosion. You know, it's just beautifully done. You know, in the final analysis, discounting all the documentary evidence that we're going to get into a little bit later, the fireball and the manifestation of the fireball is almost uniquely the physical manifestation upon which the determination of the detonation of the atomic bomb rests.
Now, one of the obstacles that you ran into during the course of your investigation was the official explanation that there simply was not enough U-235 available for a test in 1944. I wonder if you could briefly on this side encapsulate for us your search through the documentation about the U-235.
These physicists that I worked with, who were former Manhattan Project scientists, were insistent at the very beginning that I had to be able to prove that it had been sufficient U-235 produced by the time of the Port Chicago explosion to enable a nuclear weapon test. The literature universally says there was no 235 produced during 1943 or 1944. The first thing I did in December of 1980 was I found out who in the Department of Energy, two offices in the DOE, who would have that information, the product data for 44 and 43. And on December 9th, I called these people up, or December 5th, and I said, I'm working for the state of New Mexico. I need to have this data for the years 1943 through 49. And these two offices both gave me the classified data for the production of 235 for the years 1943 through 1949. That didn't satisfy everyone. So I had to keep working on that. And, you know, I knew who had done this. Philip Abelson, working at the Naval Research Laboratory, was the one who actually had produced the material that was necessary. And I kept talking to him for years, and he wouldn't tell me. Finally, Philip Abelson is the editor emeritus of Science Magazine, American Association for the Advancement of Science. One of the editors there persuaded him to write a memoir, which was published by the National Academy Press in 1991, in which he acknowledges that there was production, U-235 production, during 1943 and 1944. And then finally, the capper to that was a letter I found dated September 15, 1943, to Admiral Purnell of the Atomic Bomb Military Policy Committee from James Conant, in which James Conant informs Admiral Purnell that there's still 160 pounds of uranium hexafluoride enriched at the Naval Research Laboratory, and that that is to be transferred to the Manhattan Project. And that was all produced during 1943. So that now is proven and established beyond doubt. There was more than sufficient material to detonate the Mark II at Port Chicago in July 44.
And we'll get into what the Mark II was inside two of the broadcast. We've only got a couple of minutes left on this side. Peter, one of the things that you came across was that there was a tremendous amount of interest on the part of Los Alamos National Laboratory in this supposedly conventional explosion. Tell us about Captain William Parsons and some of the things he was involved in and his role in writing up Port Chicago for Los Alamos.
Captain William Sterling Parsons was assigned duty at Los Alamos in spring 1943 on the recommendation of Admiral Purnell and James Conant. And he was an ordnance expert, the Navy's leading expert in naval gun manufacture and the operation of naval guns, a genius in that area. He was brought in to design what turned out to be the Hiroshima weapon, a gun assembly weapon. And he also participated in the design of this Mark II, the weapon tested at Port Chicago that we're going to discuss. Immediately after the Port Chicago explosion, Captain Parsons and two Los Alamos scientists went to Port Chicago and began making intensive studies of the explosion and the effects of the explosion. And these were all reported to Admiral Purnell of the Atomic Bomb Military Policy Committee in memoranda that the first one on July 27, 1944, and they go, these memoranda continue through the end of October 1944, about 700 pages of documents that Captain Parsons and his two assistants prepared on the explosion.
Real quickly, because we're almost out of time, William Parsons has figured prominently in the development of atomic weapons, both with regard to the Hiroshima explosion and also Operation Crossroads. Encapsulate for us those points of information in our last 1 minute, if you would, Peter.
Captain Parsons was the bomb commander on the Hiroshima flight. And he armed this weapon in flight. It was a weapon that he had designed. After the war, for the Bikini tests, he was the technical director for the Bikini tests, and he also died immediately after Dr. Oppenheimer lost his security clearance, which raises some questions.
We'll talk about that, time permitting, later on in the broadcast. Do note that this very significant individual with regard to the early history of atomic weapons and the testing of same was in charge, was overseeing the tremendous amount of research and interest on the part of Los Alamos into Port Chicago. We've been visiting with Peter Vogel, the author of the online book, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, available online at www.portchicago.org. For the Record shows are being archived by WFMU on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older shows at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio-equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program 444, as there are for the other For the Record programs, within a week or so of the airing of the program. Listeners who are interested in supporting the work that I'm doing will find a portion to click on in the written description of each For the Record program. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 444, an interview with author Peter Vogel. This is being recorded on February 1st of the year 2004. My name is Dave Emery, and for Peter Vogel, thanks for listening.